drive by my house and I'll kind of look away.
All right, so this is lesson three. We're doing chapters 6 through 8, and I have called it Undoing My Creation. So review again. The theme is that we are to possess our given inheritance. We're to remember about the inheritance of who we are. We are made in the image of God, which means we are us, we are priests. We are in Trinitarian relationship. And we are to prepare for our possession by remembering that God is with us, that his withness is actually connected to our presence. His presence is connected to our presence. His existence is connected to our existence. Last week we talked about the necessity of vulnerability, that we need to be open about who we are. We're all harlots, but we're also all priests. And to be open and willing to be the first ones to go out there as harlot priests and be a priest to people who aren't priests to us yet. Be willing to do that. And in that, God says, you're going to need some cutting away. But this cutting away is going to be a healing process. So it's just as if you had a tumor and you could say, I have a tumor, but it needs to be cut away in order for me to be whole and healthy. So we don't think, most of the time, our paradigms don't think about cutting away as making people healthy, except in the health field, right? Cutting away of a cancer, cutting away of things that don't belong there, make us whole. But we don't usually think about that. So we usually like to put things on us rather than take things away from us. But what we're going to see here in the rest of Joshua is how God heals us by taking things away, by helping us to expose what is in there. So we're going to look at that. So because it starts with cutting away, for these next couple chapters, we're going to look at what cutting away looks like. What cutting away looks like in Joshua and in this physical realm. But remember that it's teaching us what it looks like within the realm of the kingdom, in our realm of reality. And I'm going to just give you a caveat, because she started her homework, and I almost want to call everybody and say, don't read that. Because she started the homework by saying, we have to fight the enemies, and she insinuated that the enemy was people. Please do not, don't take that to heart. I understand why she says that, but even Jesus says, the enemy is not people. It's never people. Our battle is not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against strongholds within our own lives, principalities that we've taken in, transactional ways we've taken in. And I say that because for some reason we have gathered together to be against people. And it's not ever in Scripture that it ever talks about like that. The only people that Jesus was ever against was who? The people who said we should be against people, right? That's the only people that he ever even talked against. And he always invited them first. Come, we're all us. And when they didn't, then he would say, look, it's not about being against people. So I give that caveat so that we don't... I've heard too many sermons about Joshua, about being, we have to fight the enemy in the world. That's, you know, people who do this and people who do that. It's not what Joshua is about, and it's not at all anywhere what Scripture supports. So I say that to just perhaps you've had sermons like that or you've heard things like that, particularly when we get to Joshua's and the Jericho wall. For some reason, we think we're storming the enemy that's, you know, over there rather than in here. So so cutting away is where we're going to start. And what we're going to see is that there is actually a pattern about this cutting away, and the pattern actually follows the Levitical priest's preparation. So if you took Leviticus, this will be familiar to you. But the way the priests went through their process is first they were chosen. They didn't go, oh, I'd like to be a priest. I'll be a priest. How did they get to be a priest? God chose them. God said, this line will be a priest. These people will be a priest. So God actually chose them called them out. Say, you will be my priest. You will be my priest. So it starts with being called out that you're his, that you belong to him, not yourself. So it's called out first, then it's being made naked, being exposed. So that's what the priests actually had to do, is they had to have someone remove all of their clothes, or they removed their clothes, depending. And this was in front of the congregation. So for some reason, we often think anytime we talk about vulnerability or nakedness, it's just before God. Well, that's not how the priests did it. The priests did it in front of people and was in front of the whole congregation. So they were called to be his first. Then they were undressed. They were naked. After being naked and undressed, does anybody know what next happened?
They were washed.
They were washed. So then so it wasn't good enough just to expose it. There's the dirt, but then they needed to be washed. And the last thing they did was dressed for celebration. So there, when everybody would see their dressing, they would understand that they were dressed for celebration, and then they could eat the covenant meal together, all of that. So, in cutting away, it is going to mean that there's going to be a loss. But the loss will not be your personhood. It will only be the covering. It's only covering that is lost, not you that is lost. So we have become so enamored with our coverings that it feels like we're getting lost. It's almost as if, you know, I don't know if this is true, but when I was a kid, I remember learning in history class that the Eskimos, when they would get so cold, they would sew the clothes onto their bodies. Actually, onto their skins. But that's what we do. We sew our coverings onto us so much that they feel like they're us. So that when God begins to take them off and cuts them off, it hurts and it feels like a loss. But he's assuring us, you're not losing you. You're only losing your coverings that aren't you to begin with. So, we begin with the wonderful story of Jericho and the walls falling down, which is a fun story, and I've seen and heard, you know, sermons where, you know, they get the congregation to get up and walk around and things like that, and I thought about doing that, but I just can't get you guys back easy enough. But I think what the fun thing about this is something I've never seen or heard, realizing really what's going on here. And what God is doing is he's actually calling us to destruct our creation. And how do I know that? Because of all the things he uses, anytime he uses something that you've seen somewhere else in the Word, there's a reason for it. So what do you see first of all? You see seven priests with seven trumpets, right? And they're supposed to circle seven times. Well, boy, when I hear the word seven and I see the word seven, where's the first mention of seven in Scripture?
Creation.
Genesis 1. God created in 7 days. And so I'm thinking, okay, creation. I wonder if he's talking about creation here. When I look at seven priests with seven trumpets, then I think again, where have I seen in Scripture seven priests with seven trumpets or something similar? Anybody have any idea?
Revelation.
In Revelation 15, we have seven angels with seven bowls of God's wrath. And it says in there that the seven angels pour out the seven bowls of wrath, and at the end of them pouring out the seven bowls of wrath, it says, and the cities of the nations fell. It is deconstructing what we have constructed. It is taking our creation, what we've created, and reversing it, reversing the pattern of what we've done. When you look at the fact that he has them encircle the wall seven times, and what have we built? We've built a wall, right? We've talked about that, that we've built this separation. Once we decided in Eden, and we continue to decide that we want to be separate, we want to be rulers of ourselves, We became separate. We built this wall. Now he asks them to encircle the wall 7 times. So the first thing that's going to happen is if you encircle something 7 times, and actually they do it 14 times, right? Because they do it 7 or 6 times and then 7 times in that last day. When you encircle the same thing 7 times, what are you going to be able to notice? Every little thing about it, right? And if we're talking about creation, the 7 days of creation, and we're reversing that, what I'm going to notice is how unlike creation my creation is. How it, God creates this beautiful world that is an open garden, right? A garden that is supposed to be growing, that has all the space and freedom to grow, right? I've built, we've built, kingdoms of walls of separation, so that when I encircle my life 7 times, when I start looking at all the aspects of my life, I see how I restrict. What was the first thing? Light. A walled city restricts light. A walled city restricts animals. It either keeps them in or keeps them out, but it doesn't give them freedom, and it restricts people, right? It's all about restriction, right? A walled city is all about restriction. Whereas God's creation was all about freedom, about giving this openness and able to grow. And if the city that I build is about restriction, it means that it's death. Because eventually there's nowhere to go, there's no growth, and when I stop growing, I die. So my creation is all about death. Not only does he have them circle it 7 times so that they discover the restrictions of the walled city, the restrictions of a transactional life, the restrictions of what we've kind of said life is all about. But he also says, don't say a word. How did God create earth in 7 days? With words, right? With his spoken word. He spoke and it was. And he even gives the same thing to Adam and Eve. He says, you start naming, you'll be co-creators with me. But what we do with our words, we've talked about this. We pull down, we bring down. We lift ourselves up, but we pull everyone else down. So our words have created a walled city. So what he says is, shut up. Your words have only created distance and separation. So I want you to be quiet. I am reversing what you've done, so let's take away your words. Your words can never justify your creation. Your words can never make it okay. You can't say, well, yeah, but this part of my life is good. This part is good. No words, because no words can justify you having built an independent life. So he asked them not to say any words. He also tells them that the Ark of the Covenant is to be where? In the middle, right? In the center. Center stage. Because if I'm trying to tear down, if I'm receiving the invitation to tear down my independent life, my way of living, if I'm receiving that invitation and I don't put God at the center, which means always thinking about his existence with mine, then I'll be doing it on my own. And if I'm doing it on my own, I'm not receiving the invitation to tear down my independence, right? So God has to be there. He has to be in the center. He has to be very obvious that I'm existing with him, that he's existing with me. Otherwise, I will begin again to build up my independent life rather than tear it down.
Jill, this keeps reminding me of Matthew, right?
Yeah,
absolutely.
About
it. So Joshua and Jesus are Joshua's the foreshadow
right.
of Jesus.
Right.
So he's physically breaking down these walls and kingdoms, because all the other people in the next chapters are essentially walls.
Right.
Kingdoms. And then you were talking about how Jesus broke down the walls, each of the walls in the temple, which
yep.
with each of his healings.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Exactly.
So it's
It's definitely the parallel. And that you should see that all through Joshua. There's a reason that Joshua's named that he gets renamed Joshua. He gets renamed Jesus, so that you see this is the foreshadowing of what Jesus is doing. So all that Joshua does here, Jesus is doing as well.
When the shout almost makes me think of his shout at the end of
yeah,
the cross.
Exactly.
Do you
well,
know what I mean?
And even more than that. So it's that and the, at the beginning. So we'll look at that. So we have God's prescription then is reversing the cycle. You're mine, not your own. Remember when they left the Garden of Eden, he became one of us rather than us. And God's saying, I'm going to reverse that. I'm going to take away that one. I'm going to take the walls away from what makes you one and make you us again. So I'm calling you to belong to us again. This is the calling of the priest. So that the calling of the priest is always a calling to bring down the walls, to bring down the separation where I've separated. In fact, in that Revelation passage I talked about, it not only says that the walls of the city fall, but it says that the great city is divided. And it talks about divided into three parts. So it shows that it's coming back together again, that three into one. So God's victory is that the enemy is defeated. And basically, the victory is that I've received the invitation, that I have agreed with reality. Yep, the walls make me one. Taking down the walls, restore my us. Restore who I am. The call to belong to God is restoring who I am. So that enemy is defeated. The wall in me, in my life, is the enemy, the very first enemy. It's the paradigm of the independent life. Of course, we all know the story of them going around the wall seven times, and then seven times the last time. And they're not supposed to say anything, reversing their words that built up that kingdom. But at the very end, the shout comes, right? The word shout there is a really interesting word. It means a war cry, but the actual original definition means it is evil. What was God's shout when he created each day and at the end of the creation? It is good. And here, when we agree with reality, we walk around our independent life, we see that we've restricted and bounded the growth of us being priests, and we declare, it is evil. This is not good. Independence is not good. No matter how much we as Americans love our independence, and we say independence is great, God says it is evil. Independence is evil. And evil means it's not what we were made for. It doesn't make us whole. Independence can never make us whole. And so that shout is a war cry. We are taking down what is evil. We are taking down this independence because it doesn't make us whole. Being the opposite of God's it is good. What God builds is good. And God builds Trinitarian relationship. He builds into us relationship rather than separateness. So God's victory is that the walls of independence are seen as evil. The second thing in his victory is that the harlot is saved. The person of Rahab is saved. She loses everything except her personhood, who she is. She is still a harlot, but she is saved. Everything else has gotten taken away. Her friends have gotten taken away. Her business has gotten taken away. Her house has gotten taken away. Her means of livelihood has gotten taken away. All of that has been taken away, but she is saved. The person of Rahab, and remember, person is the same word as parson, which is priest, has been retained. It's been saved. It's been rescued in the midst of the loss of everything else. Again, there will be a much loss when we agree that independence is evil, that independence doesn't bring life. Think about the losses you have when you agree that independence isn't good. That means you lose the ability to do anything on your own. You lose the ability to control. You lose a lot of stuff, don't you? Can you think of any time in your life where you've actually been forced into dependence?
Marriage.
Very good. So there's a loss, right? You know, it's fun. It's interesting because probably our age, except for Annie and Natalie, our age, when we got married, we didn't think about the law so much because we most of us got married pretty early, right? Now, when you guys get married, when you two get married, you're thinking much more loss because you've lived a lot more on your own, right? And I know this because Lissa getting married this summer, she said the hardest thing for her was losing her independence, losing that right, and even she didn't like losing her name. She struggled with that. And I thought, that's weird. I never struggled with that. But, you know, I went right from college to marriage. So it wasn't, I didn't feel like I ever really had all that much independence. So marriage is definitely one. What are other times in your life where you actually are forced into dependence?
Illness.
Right? You lose a lot, right? You know. You've lost the ability to drive up until recently, right? Mm-hmm. That was huge, especially in the suburbs. Mm-hmm. Right? That's huge.
And over the summer.
And over the summer, yeah, right, with three kids. You lose a lot.
Mm-hmm. Or severe damage like a storm or your house burning down or, you know.
Right. Right, exactly. Yep, exactly. So you're forced into dependence or you choose dependence. Either one, you're losing a lot, but God continues to assure you're not losing you. And that's what's important because you, connected with me, connected with others, is what life is.
When the beginning and end of our life, right?
Yep.
Our book ended.
Right.
By dependence.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly, exactly.
I think that's why, I mean, I'm a marriage counselor, so I know it, but I think this is why so many people have marital problems,
yes.
That even though they theoretically accept the we, the us, they fight tooth and nail every stage, every day, through every single thing in life,
right.
To do things their way,
right.
Their family's way,
right.
That you really, really resist against that.
Right, right. Yeah, that's kind of natural for us. More so in this culture than in some other cultures. Where us is much more understood and accepted as part of being human.
Can I ask about?
Yeah.
I was curious. At the end of chapter 6,
mm-hmm.
Joshua sends the two men to get her, and
mm-hmm.
they placed her outside the camp.
Mm-hmm.
But then they say Joshua saved her, and she lived in the midst.
Uh huh.
So it's kind of like we say, oh, well. We'll spare you,
uh-huh.
but we won't really save you. But Joshua brought her in.
Right, exactly.
Right into the midst like Jesus would.
Exactly, exactly. So you see the conflict that the Israelites still have, right? They're going to do what they're supposed to do, but they're not taking it to heart.
Yeah.
They're going to take her out, and they're not sure they want to bring her in as us. But Joshua brings her in.
Mm-hmm.
This is, and he, of course, goes first. He's the first priest, and which is why he chooses, Jesus personally chooses to have Rahab in his line, which is, I mean, that exploded for them, for the Israelites. This is what it means to be a priest, to be connected. And as we go farther, we'll see how much need to understand our harlotry, that God accepts that. So good pointing out that. So, then, of course, we talk about the spoils of the victory. So the first thing you need to understand about this battle, this being the first, it's different than all the rest of the battles in that it's the first battle. It's the first place that they actually harvest something of the land, that they actually get a piece of the land. So it's the very first battle, the first acquiring of their possession, of their inheritance. Therefore, it's first fruits. So if you haven't taken some of our other courses, the first fruits means God told the Israelites, look, when I give you a good harvest, you give me the first portion of it. And the reason you give me the first portion is so that you understand that it all belongs to me, that it's mine, and that I'm giving everything to you as a gift. So that the first portion given to me is to remind you that it all belongs to me. That what you get of the harvest isn't because of your effort, but it's because it's mine and I'm giving it to you as a gift. Oh, there's so many ways I want to go with this, and I'm not quite sure. God wants us to understand not only that all of life is a gift, but that He is a good giver as well. That He will give out of His treasures. He will give you more than is necessary and abundance. He will give it to you. But if I don't give Him the first, then I will not see everything I have as a gift. I will begin to think that it's my due. And in fact, He tells in Deuteronomy, He says, now be careful when you go into the land and you build houses and you reap harvest. If you don't remember who I am, if you don't remember that I gave you the land, that you will become prosperous, that you will have all this stuff, and you will begin to say to yourself, wow, I have done much here, and by the power and strength of my own hand do I have all of this. And then you will be disconnected from me. He warns them of that before they get in there. So give first fruits to remind yourself every harvest. This is God's, it belongs to Him, and He's giving us out of His treasures. If I don't give to Him first, I will forget that. And I will say, oh, this is out of my own hand, it's my effort, so I'll just take it. Then I will not be a receiver anymore. I will be a taker. And that's where we go from there. So first fruits is pretty important here. So he says, remember that the first fruits belong to Him, that the stuff under the man. So he says, not only does all that go to me, and he says it in 17, the city shall be under the ban. It and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. We'll talk about under the ban in a second. And then in 19, but all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord. That's first fruits he's talking about there. So they understood that. They knew what he was talking about. Yep, that goes to the Lord so that we remember that it belongs, all of it belongs to the Lord. And what we get of it is a gift. It's not because we didn't get it because we worked for it. Because of our efforts. We got it because it's a gift. He's already giving it all to them. They're just going and getting it. Then he says in 18, but as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban. So he's talking about these things under the ban that belong to the Lord. Keep yourselves from that. The word keep yourselves, we've talked about the same word over and over again, means to keep a garden well tended. And since we are redoing creation, we're tearing down our creation, and now making sure that we're tending His creation, keep the garden well tended, which means attend to all of those things I've given you. Going back to Genesis, what are all the things God has given them? All the trees in the garden, all the animals in the garden, everything, except for one thing He does not give them. What is that? The tree of knowledge of good and evil. He says, that's mine. That belongs to me. That's not yours. Don't tend that. Don't go near it. Don't look at it. That's mine. That's the connotation in Genesis. That belongs to me. So when he says, keep yourselves from the things under the ban, he says, tend the garden as I've told you in the very beginning. Tend to all of the things that I've given you. You don't need to tend to the garden, to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, because it's not yours. It's mine. And it's there as a reminder of first fruits, as a reminder of there are things that are mine that you are to leave alone so that you know that it's all mine, and what you have, all the trees in the garden, are a gift from me. Which reminds me of the field trip that we did go on, was it last week we went on? I absolutely love, so in this church, in the very front, behind the altar, painted a picture of heaven. Guess how they painted it as? As the Garden of Eden. First church I've ever seen do that. Actually had all the trees, and they had the tree of life in the middle there. It was beautiful, all these trees. That was their picture of heaven. So, keep the garden, keep yourselves, tend the garden, Why, he says, so that you don't covet, so that you don't bring trouble on yourselves. So that you don't covet, in other words, so that you don't take what is not yours. Keep yourselves away from the things that belong to God so that you don't take and desire what is not yours. So that you don't think that it might be yours or that it could be yours. And that's really important for where we're going here with Achan and everything else. And so that you don't bring trouble. Because once you covet it and think that it is yours, it could be yours, what is God's could be yours, you will definitely bring trouble. So, that's chapter 6. That's the wall of Jericho. Does that give you a little bit deeper understanding of the wall of Jericho? This idea of independence and going around. So it's not going against the enemy out there, but it is taking down, answering that call that you belong to him, taking down that wall that separated you into just one. So we go into chapter 7, and we have, remember I said it's going in the cycle of the priests. So the priests first get called to belong to him. The second thing is the priests get disrobed, right? So exposing the hidden spoil here. So let's talk about the priests. The priests are disrobed in front of everyone so that everyone sees that they are just like them. They have the faults. Aaron, he was the one who led them into harlotry. He was a man just like them. When he gets completely naked, they all see, he's exactly like me. He's no Superman. He's no God. He's just like me. He's got all the faults. He's got a wart there, and he's got a freckle there, and he's got a crooked toe. And they get to see him just as he is, completely exposed. But they also see that God has chosen him. So they have this odd tension here. Here he is, this defective man, and God has chosen him to be a priest, to give him power to help other people possess their inheritance. They see both. The priest is naked so that they can never hide themselves as if they were qualified to be a priest, as if they deserve to be a priest, as if they were a little better than everybody else, therefore they're a priest. They could never do that because everyone saw them naked. You don't qualify any more than I do. You're just as crooked and you're just as defective as I am. That was the purpose for them, to be able to be naked in front of everyone. So everyone understood, including the priest, and the priest understood, I'm just as effective as everyone else. I don't deserve this priesthood. I don't deserve this power to bring other people up, to lift other people up. I don't deserve power at all. I'm given it as a gift. That makes a huge difference to start out your priesthood that way. Because if a priest came fully dressed, without vulnerability, without openness to say, I'm just like you, what happens?
And they become much better than us, and they're not like us.
Ah.
And that's kind of what happens.
That's exactly.
Jesus was
yep.
upset about them.
Exactly. And that is what happens with all of us. Without vulnerability, everyone on the outside, including the priest, says, well, there must be a reason that you're a priest. You must deserve it because you must be good at this and must be better than me in this. And you must be better, therefore you've gotten power. So that the power is ascribed to being their effort rather than a gift. And if that's the case, then it's going to become corrupted. It's going to be, oh, well, okay, so the priest sees that he's better, so he deserves to get more power and more honor. And then he begins to use his power to get more honor and to take advantage of that power. I'm better than them, so I deserve more. I just read an article a couple weeks ago about a pastor who said, I'm the head of this congregation, so I should get 50% of what comes in.
What?
And I know the pastor, and I read it and I just thought, whoa, get unclothed there. I mean, this is not the purpose of being a priest at all. to say that my efforts, I lead this congregation, I do this, look at all I do, rather than, oh, I'm naked. I am just as crooked. I have all of this stuff. This is a gift. So you treat a gift much different than the things that you earn, right? Very, very differently. And then that pastor, that priest, and the people will all support them to get stuff to honor them more for their own gain, to help themselves, to make them feel valuable for what they do rather than who they are. A harlot priest who's been chosen.
Well, it's not even just the nakedness that's striking, too. It's the fact that they're washed by others, right?
Mm-hmm.
In front of everyone else.
Yep.
And I was thinking, like, now, you know, people used to just wash.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Still do in the Middle East.
Right,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and my Swedish friends, I mean.
Yeah, right.
Like jump in the ocean, right. Jump in the shower, freaking out. But like this whole idea, I mean, even David saw Bathsheba, she was bathing out there. People just clean themselves in front of
yes.
each other. We would
yes.
So to me, this process of becoming clean was always
mm-hmm.
too.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, we clean ourselves up when nobody's looking.
Yep.
And we have this, you know what I'm saying? Like, so you think that this is the way I always act.
Right.
You never see
right.
that process of me getting clean.
Exactly.
And I think the priest
the
thing,
we never
right.
see you
we never,
fully
right.
dirty.
No.
Right.
right.
Mm-hmm. And I think the priest thing is not just the vulnerability, but the process of God
yep.
cleaning is also public. You know what I mean? So
absolutely.
It's not like, here's my stuff.
Right.
It's also, here's my stuff, and here's what God is doing to, like,
right, right,
wash
right,
me
and
it takes the community.
Right,
to,
right. exactly,
wow.
exactly.
And it takes someone else to kind of,
yeah.
like, ooh,
ooh, yeah. Can I wash you? Yeah, exactly, exactly.
Off,
you know, when
you missed a spot.
right, right, exactly, exactly. When Lissa lived in Syria, she said she. I remember her writing back. She said, so the hammam is, you know, a thing that you go to. It's
oh, yeah.
it's the public baths. And she would go to there. And she said one day, she said she went to the hammam. And not only are they all naked there, and of course there are men in one side and women in the other, but she said this old, old Arab woman turned to her and gave her a sponge and she said, would you please wash me? And Liz is like, okay, I'm in here naked already and now you're asking me to wash your body. And the woman thought nothing of it because that's what they do.
Well, yeah, it's just like we walk around on this earth with our skeletons in the closet, right?
Right.
We don't.
Of course.
Everything's great. Everything's fine. Everything's good. We have absolutely lost the art of vulnerability
right.
at all.
Right.
I will say. So I did do that when we were in Turkey, and I will say, if anyone has the opportunity, it is the most vulnerable, intimate
yes.
thing
yes.
I've ever experienced.
Yeah.
Is like having someone completely wash
yep.
you.
Yeah.
Totally
yep.
like. And the really funny thing is they give you a linen.
Yes,
like
a little tiny thing like this. Yeah, exactly. Oh, goodness. Actually, both Christian and Lissa came home after living in Syria for a year and both said, we miss the hammams. That's the one thing they missed most was the hammams.
But when you come out completely vulnerable, you scare people.
Of course you do.
Uh-huh.
Because nobody else wants to
see.
Your
dirtiness.
And what is a priest supposed to do? Go first.
Yes.
Right? Go
and
first.
That's how you show people
yeah,
how to live
exactly. Exactly.
Is
exactly.
That dirt and all. And,
yep.
And that's, so if you look at, I mean, a lot of things, there's a lot in popular culture right now that's about vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
but that's the whole point.
Yep.
Is you can't live communally, you can't live Trinitarianly if you are holding back your dirt.
That's right. Which is exactly what we have in here, right? Here we have Achan, who's
yeah,
hiding.
You're right. I mean, it does cause rejection.
Yep. It does.
I feel like I tell you pretty much anything you want to know, and I feel like I do sometimes, and people just run the other way.
They do.
It's scary, right?
See,
it's scary.
That's the loss,
yeah,
though. And
right.
That's what I struggle
yeah.
with is I have lost a lot in the last year by being vulnerable and being real.
Mm-hmm.
And I still, even though all of this, everything around me, I still go back to maybe I shouldn't have done that. But that wasn't mm-hmm. That's not who I'm
that's
called
right.
to be.
That's right.
Who you're called to be.
Right.
And it's the death.
It's
the death
is,
of one kingdom.
Right.
It is.
Exactly.
And but it still hurts.
It does hurt.
I don't think you know how you touch people when you're vulnerable, though, too.
Right.
Because I think many times, you know, if I've shared a story with a small group of people,
somebody later will say, wow, I thought like your kids were just perfect. I'm like, no. I think that if you show that, it gives them, it allows them to go, oh, she's just like people are just, we're the same.
Yeah.
Like, we're all
yeah,
flawed,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But I think that you don't necessarily realize the seed that you plant when you,
right.
when you share that vulnerability.
Yep.
You know, like somebody
mm-hmm.
might run, but somebody else might go, wow,
yeah.
like.
But they're
right.
running from their own nakedness.
Well, ex- that, and
right.
that's exactly
and
what they're doing. Right. If she's nude, what does that mean for me?
Yeah, and you got to take that ego, that independence out of it, because
yep.
it, there's nothing quite as charming as being completely exposed and vulnerable and having somebody push you right away.
Well, so much for keeping the phones off.
Yeah. And, you know, to be cast out by somebody for that.
Yes.
It is the worst possible feeling in the world if you take it into, if you
right.
look at it with independence.
Right. So let's look at Achan, who does exactly that. He hides, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, we start out the chapter with an unexpected defeat. An unexpected defeat is always an invitation to nakedness. What's going on here? Why is there a defeat? Our connection with each other is such that any disconnection in the family affects everybody. So think about your own family. When there's disconnection in there, can everyone go right on with all their connections? No, they can't. There's definitely an affectedness for everybody in there. So it's an invitation to nakedness. What's going on? I'm going to be naked so you can be naked. Whatever. What's going to be going on? So then we have Joshua. Interesting, because I bet your first response was, well, Joshua, you're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to complain to God. You're not supposed to be. Because it sounds a lot like the people in Israel, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
What's the difference between how Joshua speaks and how the people spoke in the desert? Because it's almost the same words. Anybody know the difference? Who were the people complaining to? Moses and each other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who's Joshua complaining to?
To God.
To God. That's the difference.
He knows that there's something wrong.
He knows there's something wrong, and he's being vulnerable and honest. God, I don't get it. Something's wrong here. You said you've given us this land, and now we've gotten defeated. I don't get it. What's going on? Should we have stayed back? Not in Egypt, he doesn't say. Should we have stayed on the other side of the river where we already had land? He's complaining to God. We have the Book of Lamentations. We have half of the Psalms that are David and Jeremiah, thank you, saying to God the whole time, I don't like this, God. This is hard, God. That's honesty and vulnerability. It's not honesty and vulnerability when you're complaining to somebody else about what God's done. That's behind God's back. Joshua's saying, I don't get it. I'm vulnerable here, God. I don't get it. This doesn't make sense, and I don't like this. That's what he does. Nakedness for Joshua always says, I need help here because I don't get it. I am not perfect. I am completely deformed, and it seems to me like it should be this way, and it's not. So we have that. But then we have the understanding that the body is suffering because there's one person who's not willing to be vulnerable, open, naked. Somebody is hiding something. And we, of course, find out it's Achan. And he basically says, all Israel is acting unfaithful. And we'll get to why he says all Israel and not just one person. But he basically says Israel is acting unfaithfully. The word there, acting unfaithfully, actually means to cover up. But even more, boy, my eyesight. To deliberately deflect from faith. In other words, I don't believe God can or will give me life, so I'll get it for myself. That's what it means to act unfaithfully, to hide, to cover up, to put a separation between God and I, because I don't think that God is going to lift me up, so I'll lift myself up. I'll get for myself what I think I need. So let's go through what Achan does, and then we'll look at what we do and see if we do the same kinds of things. So we first see that Achan sees. What does he see? What? What are the goodies? Name the goodies.
The
Gold?
Silver?
Gold, silver, one more thing. A mantle. A mantle. What's a mantle?
A covering.
A covering. He sees a covering. And it's a mantle from Shinar. Anybody recognize that word, Shinar? If you've ever done Daniel, you recognize it. Shinar is the plains of Babylon. He sees a covering from Babylon. He sees, basically at that time, Babylon isn't a strong military power at the time, but Babylon is pretty much the center of fashion. He sees a covering that's going to make him look beautiful. Does this sound very familiar?
Yes.
He sees something that's beautiful. Mm-hmm. Where?
Garden of Eden.
Yeah, in the Garden of Eden. Okay. Again, Joshua is all about, look, we're returning to the garden because we're going to make this right. He sees, Eve sees, same kind of thing. He sees this gold, the silver, and this mantle, this covering from Babylon. And as he sees it, he covets it. But before we talk about the coveting, let's talk about the seeing. What is that stuff in this chapter? What are they called, all of that stuff? The gold, the silver, the mantle. What is that called?
Under the ban.
Under the ban. Mm-hmm. The word there is cherem, C-H-E-R-E-M, cherem, or harem, or harem. Anybody hear that word?
Mm-hmm.
The word harem in Arabic is forbidden. But when you think about harem, that word, because we use it in English, what do we think about?
Women.
Yeah.
Ladies.
They're forbidden to whom?
To everybody but the guy that owns them.
To everybody except the guy who owns them.
Yeah.
Who is what? The king,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The harem belongs to the king. Harem means forbidden because it belongs to someone else. So when it says under the ban, put the word harem or harem. What is it that he sees? He sees things under the ban. Now, if you've ever watched any of the old movies, the harem not only belonged to the king and it didn't belong to you, but were you even allowed to see the women in the harem?
No.
You're not supposed to ever go to the court of the harems, to the harem court. Somebody in the Bible, anybody belong to a harem in the Bible?
Esther.
Esther belonged to the king's harem. She belonged to the king. This is what he sees. And it says, keep yourself from those. You're not even supposed to go in that court. You're not supposed to look at that. What is the harem? What is the harem in Genesis? Genesis 1.
The tree
of the knowledge of good and evil. It doesn't belong to us. The right to decide what is good and what is evil, the right to divide life, doesn't belong to us. It belongs to God. It's for his use because he knows how to divide life. He knows how to give life. And if when we divide it, we don't, because we are so immersed in a transactional way of life, we'll start dividing life into good and evil, and we'll say, this is good, so I'm going to take this, and this is evil, so I'm not going to receive this. But it's not our domain to divide life. It's not our domain to call that good and that evil. Ours is all the good God gives us, the tree of life. He wants to give us life, and that's where we're to receive life. Whatever it is he gives us, it's life. It's not our domain to decide good or evil. He looks at the harem. That's what he sees. And he decides, I have the right to choose what's good and evil. I have the right to choose what will make life for me and what will not. What will make me valuable, because that's really what life is all about. How I get worth. I have the right to choose how to get worth. I have the right to decide what will give me life, what will make me feel valuable, what will self-satisfy me, what will make me feel good.
The crazy thing is he can't even really wear it because it'll be real obvious. That's
so exactly true. Yes.
Like, will he ever even be able to use it?
Right.
Just gonna be buried.
And that's exactly it. That's what we talk about, this restricted life that we've built.
I would think of that when people steal this amazing masterpiece.
What are you going to do with it? Right, exactly, exactly. And they always feel, at some point I'll be able to do it, right? Right. At some point I'll be able to wear this, and then people will see me as fashionable, and then I'll be valuable. I won't, in other words, I'm not going to accept the fact that I'm valuable because I'm a harlot priest. I'm valuable because of what I can put on. I'm valuable because of what I can do. I'm valuable because I have all this gold and silver that I can buy all sorts of things to make me look valuable, to make me look worthy, to make me look that I've done so much good that I'm valuable. Do you see what's happening here with Achan?
Yes.
Does it happen with us?
All the time.
So, he sees harem. He's not even supposed to be seeing harem, but he sees it as maybe it's available to me. I'm not supposed to go to the tree of knowledge of good and evil, to the experiencing division between in life. I'm not even supposed to go there, let alone then decide that could be mine. I could have that. I could have the right to decide what's going to make life for me and what isn't going to make life for me. And I'm just not capable of doing that. I know we think we are. In fact, we always say things like that, right? But I'm not. I am not capable of doing that. So the last thing he does, of course, is take. Well, and this is what we say. I know what I need, right? I know how to satisfy. I know how my needs get met. So I will take it. It's available. It's mine. So I should take it because I have the right to decide. And so, of course, he takes it. I know what will make me feel good. I will know what will make me feel valuable. And so he takes it, and it's stealing the harem, stealing the right to decide what is going to be good for me, what is going to be bad for me. And really, if we had gone all the way back to, I'm a priest, do I know what will make me a good priest? No, I really don't. God does. But now he's saying, it's going to make me feel good. It's going to make me feel valuable. It's going to lift me up. He takes what's going to lift him up rather than receiving it from somewhere else. So, the naked truth. Let's talk about us. How naked are we? Do I steal? Do I take the right to decide what is good for me, to make me a good priest, to make me who I am, to make me whole, and what is not good for me? Do I ever do that? Do I ever say I have the right to decide that? Yeah. Why? Why do I do that?
Because we don't think God will give it to us.
That's exactly it.
Yep.
That's exactly it. I do not believe that God is... No, I don't believe God is a good covenant partner, right? I don't believe he's going to provide me what I really need because I know what I really need.
Scarcity mentality.
Scarcity mentality, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I know what I need. God's not going to give it to me, so I should go out and take it. And once we tell ourselves that, we tell ourselves, well, I deserve that, right?
I earned that.
I worked hard for this. I should get this. Never remembering if I don't give my first fruits to God, then I will think I earned it. Anytime you say, I earned this, no, you didn't give first fruits to God. No, you didn't say, this belongs to God. It's his right to divide it how he wants. That's
and
very true. That's
there was
right.
Work in the garden.
Exactly. That's very true. That's very true.
Or even how we used to work the land, if we're more in tune with the fact that anything could happen. Like, do you know what I mean? There could be a bad year, and
right.
there could be a good year,
right.
and it wouldn't be our doing that produced a great crop. Right?
Yep, that's exactly it. Yep. Yep.
And now we totally.
Right, we think
credit.
We produce all
right.
this crop.
Right.
You know? And we think the point of working is to get.
Is to get. Right, right.
And the more we work, the more
right.
we can get. For
right,
ourselves.
Exactly.
And it's why it's, you know, it was really upsetting to me. I was sitting with a child last night, who's 12, and she started crying and saying, if I don't hurry up and pick something to do and be great at it, I'm never going to succeed. I'm never going to get a scholarship. And then I'll never get a job that makes a lot of money. And I said, well, what is it that you feel that you're here to do? And she said, well, I really want to make music, but I'm never going to make any money at that. And I looked at her and I said, who decided that that was the goal? And this is a 12-year-old kid, so it's being repeated and replayed uh-huh. and permeated through
right.
our
yeah.
entire
right.
culture. And it's so sad because what it does is it takes away people from calls to service.
Mm-hmm.
No one's going to serve.
That's right.
You don't make any money
nope.
serving. So when you go that individual way,
yep.
God, our community just
Yep.
That's right. I mean, she sobbed.
I can't do what I want to do, what I think I'm meant to do.
Or that there would be separation between the person who pursued, you know, finance and the person who pursued music and see them as different.
Right.
Do you know
right.
what I mean? Like
yes.
they're both doing what they're great at.
Right.
Right.
But we've separated as one providing well and the other one just caring. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And she literally suffered over, but people are so happy when I sing. Yeah. That's why you should keep singing. Because it's giving, right? So we're not a giving group.
Yep. So if I steal because I don't believe God's going to give me life, that he knows best what's going to make me a good priest, that's why I steal. How do I steal then? First of all, how do I steal from God's first portion? We're going to talk about the normal things that we usually talk about when we talk about this, and then we'll talk about more. So how do I steal from God's first portion of money?
Withholding it.
Withholding it completely or not giving it first, right? So I don't give it first to God, to God's kingdom, whatever that looks like, and I'm not going to tell you what that looks like. If I don't give it to him first because I say, well, I got to make sure I have enough for my bills, right? That I can pay my bills. I have to make sure I can pay my bills. Just go down that slippery slope. What are my bills? The things that I decided I needed, the things that I decided I wanted. I want to pay those first. And then I'll pay God. But if I do that, then I forget that I have the money and I have the things because they're gifts from God and not because I deserve them. Not because I earned them, not because I worked for them. So I do that with my money. I do that with my time. Oh, and by the way, when we say I need enough for my bills, what's the expression that I usually use? I have to have enough to cover my expenses, right? To cover my expenses. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm doing. I'm covering. Time. How do I steal the first fruits of time from God?
Not making him a priority.
Yeah. So I don't give him, I'm not talking to him first. I have a lot of things to do and then I'll talk to him. I have a lot of things to do and then I will listen to him. And we, of course, we always say talk to him first instead of listen. Which means, so the time, we don't think God's giving us time. We think it's our time, right? And I need more time to do these things. So I'm going to get my time, and then I'll give God time. Whatever that giving time looks like. And that's a whole nother study. We talk about our abilities and our talents. Do I first minister to God, which means ministering to others? Or do I first do for myself? Do I use my talents and abilities to puff up myself, to make my reputation good, to build up? So do I spend a lot of my time, most of my time, my first time, doing things that make me look good so that people know I'm a good whatever? I am a good gardener. I'm a good housekeeper. I'm a good manager of time. I am a good wife. I'm a good mother. I'm a good minister in the church. Do I use it for that? Because sometimes I can minister to others for the purpose of making sure that I look good, right? Right? Mm-hmm. I'm taking away then my talents for him to help others to possess the inheritance so that I can get my inheritance. And I can never take my inheritance. I can only receive it.
Well, here's why the cutting is hard, Joe. It's because most of the time, it's both.
Yes.
Like, it's never really like, I'm just doing this to look good.
Right.
Or I'm just doing this to provide for my family first. Mm-hmm. It's usually both.
Yep.
And that's why the cutting of that is so difficult.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Well, and in a minute, we'll get to that and look at those two sides. What about intimacy? Do I give my intimacy to others that it doesn't belong to because I haven't first given my intimacy to God and staying within that intimacy, then give intimacy to others? So in intimacy, I mean really close relationships, like a husband and a wife. Do I give it to God first so that within that intimacy, then I'm able to give intimacy? Or do I give intimacy to others in order for me to feel loved? Is that why I'm giving intimacy? Yeah, exactly. That like oh, that is why I give intimacy sometimes, right? So that I feel loved. Thanks. Just press off. Thank you. These are just little questions I started to come up with, and I realized we could do a whole two sessions on just exploring these. I just want to start poking at you a little bit, because these are areas that we need to understand. We are like Achan. We steal and we hide. Just like that. What about, how do I steal from God by stealing from others? How about love? How do I steal love from others? Anybody have any ideas? How about when someone makes you mad, hurts you? Ah, then I withhold it, right? Well, they hurt me, so I'm going to withhold my love. I'm going to not talk to them. I'm going to avoid them. I'm just going to be snotty to them. I'm going to not give them the love so they understand how I feel. And really what I'm saying is because they need to understand I need love. And so how am I going to go about showing that I need love? By not giving love? Exactly. Yes, exactly. So do you see how completely schizophrenic we are as far as I'm going to get what I want by stealing either from God or from others because I think that will get me what I want. When you lay it out, it seems ridiculous that we do that. Tell me I'm not the only one who has ever done that. And then it just happened to me this week. Somebody was rude to me and walked away, and I thought, well, fine. I'll walk away too. And they confronted me, and they said, I laughed because they said, well, why aren't you talking to me? And I said, well, because you're not talking to me. And they said, so that's how you solve it? By not talking to me? And, you know, I wanted to argue. But it was you who went first. And, of course, as soon as I heard that, I thought, you're a priest. You go first. You give. You don't take away. You don't steal. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Anybody ever do that?
Yes.
Because sometimes I feel like I'm the only one. And sometimes I walk away thinking, am I the only one who does that to people?
But what is
better than that?
Well, right, because what does the alternative look like? You know, we don't...
Yeah, the alternative looks like bringing down the wall of independence, right?
Right.
That's exactly what it looks like. It looks like, okay, and so I've struggled with this for the last 3 days. I mean, this happened 3 days ago. And like, so, okay, fine, I will be a priest. I'll go first. I will give. I will lift you up. And I lift you up, and the person still is like, just kind of like, I'll answer you, but I won't initiate any... And of course, and then I'm like, fine, I'm not going to initiate either. And then I go back and I think, oh.
Yeah, but yeah, you got to be a priest.
Okay, I got to be a priest. God is with me. God is giving me love. Okay, go back again. Because it's hard, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we want love so badly that we're going to defend it and we're going to say, I want love. I'm building me a wall here so that you know I want love. But it does exactly the opposite. It never brings us life to steal, to take away what God is giving us as something that will... And what was that? The fact that someone wasn't talking to me actually was God's gift to say, I'm building up your priesthood here. I'm helping you. I'm giving you an opportunity to be a priest, to go first. It was building up my priesthood. That was good for my priesthood. Now, would we have ever thought that that was good for our priesthood? No. We would never choose that. But God knows, in order for me to learn how to go first, I have to go first, right? I got to step out. I got to put my toe in that water. And I won't put my toe in that water if somebody else already did it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
This is the mystery of how God works in our lives. Yeah.
He's showing you where there's walls.
Say that?
He's showing you where there's walls.
Exactly. That's exactly what he's doing. I'm showing you, I'm trying to expose all the places you have walls still. I'm trying to expose the places that you're hiding, pretending you don't have walls. You do have walls. You do have things you're hiding. You're hiding things that belong to me. Let's expose that. Let's expose it. This is a good thing if I expose that. How do I steal time from others? I wish Jill Ryan were here, because she would say the first thing I would say, which is what happened to me the other day. Somebody's just speeding by, like probably going 65 miles an hour down Napa Boulevard as I'm running. And I'm thinking, what are you doing? You're trying to get ahead. You're trying to get more time and making sure that others don't have as much time, right? Because when you speed, you cut in front of people, you go through yellow lights where people have been waiting to get through the light, turning left. They're waiting, waiting, and you speed through that yellow light.
Or in the traffic from Riddick.
Or in the traffic. How many of you going down Washington for the last couple of weeks are like, you know it's going down to one lane, and you're like, no, I'll let you in, but no more, because I have got to make sure I get one car ahead of you.
Yeah, and you're like,
because my time is important. Yes, exactly. Or thinking in your head, they should all be getting in this lane way ahead of time. They know there's only one lane. What are they doing? And my engineer husband would say, well, Jill, engineering-wise and making it work, they shouldn't all get in one line because it just makes the line longer. He always has. We talk about those kind of weird things.
He's one of the guys that goes up on the lane all as far as he can.
He does.
That's what all the engineers say you're supposed to do.
That's right. See? It is. Yes. What about your good word? How do you steal your good word? Remember, we build up the city with our word, right? With our words. How do I steal that good word? Kind of, I think, Karen, you said something about we say to other people, right? We tell other people that we gossip about them. Oh, they're not. You shouldn't be friends with them. But we never say you shouldn't be friends with them. We just give them tidbits enough to make them have a reason to not be friends with them, right? Or to not talk with them. Or to say, they hurt me. We do this all the time, right? Well, they hurt me. And what do we want from them? When we tell somebody else, that other person hurt me, what do we want from them?
Yeah,
we want more than sympathy, right? We want
validation.
Come on, you be mad at them too, right? You do this too, come on. We do this, I just did this the other week. And of course, my good friend had to point out, do you realize what you're doing here? you want somebody to side with you, and you're upset that they're not siding with you. That's not what we're called for. You're trying to steal your good word from them. You take away your support in order for you to get what you want, in order for you to look better. You don't tell both sides of the story, you only tell your side of the story. How many of you have ever told both sides of the story when something happens, right?
Yeah.
Probably rarely.
Or it's your version of both sides of the story. Yeah. Both sides of the story, but it's your version.
When we feel that strongly, we would never make their version favorable.
Right.
Right.
Of course.
Ever.
Right. No.
I mean, John's version is never. I can imagine if I would practice this just in my marriage alone.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's exactly right.
That's the tension, right? Like,
yes.
The tension of thinking, well, I either have to be right or wrong. Like, I can't be both.
Right. Exactly.
So I can't be in an argument where I do both.
Right. Exactly.
You need to choose a kingdom. You need to choose
right.
If you're on my side.
Right.
If you're yep. For or against.
Yep. Exactly.
So
exactly.
Isn't this a huge struggle with your kids? Like, my daughter has an insane desire to be right. And how do you have to really show this in practice to your kids,
yes,
if you want them to get it. Because if you're fighting with your husband as I do, and he says, oh, did you see blah, 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 and I'm like, no, that's not what it was, and then I correct him, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm always correcting him, and then when she can't sit with this feeling of not being right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get frustrated with her, well, honey, everybody makes mistakes. We're not supposed to be right. We're not supposed to be righteous. And then she'll say, but you just told Dad. You just corrupted him. Like, it's really hard to live it in practice. And because you can't just tell someone this.
Right.
You have to show it to them.
You have to practice. You have to go first.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mike and I are still really bad with each other in a lot of ways. So we continually have to point, because my kids get scared then that we're going to get divorced again. And we continually have to say to them, we mess up a lot of times.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. This is life. Life is messy.
We mess up.
Think about the work of a priest. If there was, do you ever watch the show Dirtiest Jobs?
Yes.
Uh-huh. The priest would be the dirtiest job. Because think about what they do all day long. What do? Slaughter animals all day long. Take out their entrails. They are like in it, and they are full of blood every single day. Mm-hmm. Being a priest is messy. If you think you can be a priest and keep your white linen clean, mm-hmm. you're not being a priest.
And going out and walking among the lepers.
Exactly. So how do I hide or cover up? How do I hide the fact that I'm trying to steal from God's harem? How do I cover up that? I do it in two ways. And I know this is going to sound weird, but I do it in either being completely a saint or completely a harlot. One of the two. I play up my sainthood by, I do lots and lots of good things, right? I'm so involved in the church. I'm just always busy with the church. I am a saint. This is great. This is, you know, because I don't want anyone to ever think I'm a harlot. I don't want anyone to ever see my harlotry. I'm valuable because of what I do. So I play up my sainthood, or I play up my harlotry. And this is one we do all the time. I do this constantly, never thinking about that's what I'm doing. I excuse my behavior by saying that's my personality. And this is how we use it. And we use it with the with all the psychological tools that we've learned are so useful, but we use them in the wrong way. We say either you guys have heard me say this, well, I'm an introvert, so I shouldn't have to talk on the phone. Because introverts don't talk on the phone. And I leave it at that. I'm a harlot. I mean, I'm a harlot. So, you know, what else would I do? I'm a harlot. My Myers-Briggs. I'm an INJ. And I don't use Myers-Briggs because I don't like what I come out as in Myers-Briggs. So I never use that. But, you know, or your Enneagram number. Well, I'm a 1, so of course I do that. The problem is all of those were meant to be tools of helping you recognize what your tendencies are to respond to things. Those are your tendencies. But like in the Enneagram and even in the Myers-Briggs or the, what's the one that's where you're either a golden retriever or otter or a beaver. Yeah, I'm a beaver. Yeah, whatever that is. All of those were meant to say, this is your tendency, but your wholeness includes all of those. You're all of those. Your tendency is to go this way. But we use it as, well, that's who I am and I can't be anybody else. And if that's the case, what I'm saying is I'm a harlot and I can't be anybody else. But we see Rahab, the harlot, saying I'm a harlot, but I can birth the Christ. I am a harlot and a priest. I am both a saint and a sinner. I am both. And I'm always both. And as we'll see later, even Christ sits and stays in that tension of being both. That's how I hide, though. I hide by not showing up, by who I am. I'm not going to show that I'm both saint and sinner. I'm not going to expose myself. I'm going to put on one covering or the other, but I'm not going to show people both. It's rare that I would do that. But that's the vulnerability. That's the calling. The calling is bring down the walls. Let me expose you so that I can wash you. I can't wash you if you don't let me see the dirt, if you don't let me see that you're both in those places. And when I act as a priest, then I'm using the priesthood as a covering, as if that's really all I am, that I'm so good. Well, that's not true ever. And it's not true that I'm always a harlot ever. Does that make sense to you? Or is that a little bit... Yes, Kristen.
I have a perfect example in the last 24 hours. Mm-hmm. So my dad and I got in this huge fight this summer. He was screaming at me. It was really hurtful. And he tried to send me a gift last week to make up for it. It made me even more angry. Mm-hmm. So I was really... I wouldn't respond. I was really upset, venting to friends yesterday. So then as I'm driving down the road, after I'd already told people how mean he was, God says to me, he feels like you're disappointed in him.
And I'm like, so I haven't restored yet. I'm going to figure out time to talk to him. But it was like, yeah, I see my ownership of the ugliness.
Mm-hmm.
And I see, yes, I can restore by confessing that. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
So I feel like
right.
I'm getting to live this.
Yes. Yeah. It's definitely, and what you need to understand in Jericho, or in Joshua, it's not a formula of we bring down our walls, we get exposed, we get washed, and we're done. In fact, we know that because of what happens in Judges. We know that it's the cycle. It will go over and over and over again. Always over and over again. The priests, when they were done ministering, had to get washed. Had to get exposed, washed, and then dressed again. Mm-hmm. So it's a cycle. It will happen over and over again. It's not a process that happens, you know, here, oh, you're done. Your wall of independence is done. You never have to worry about that again. As we all know, right? Because we all go back to that. It will happen over and over and over again.
That's why God gives us a lifetime.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. Which is why, again, the marching around is mm-hmm. seven. It's seven is a week. A week is supposed to be a whole life. Mm-hmm. That wholeness. So those are just little pieces I want you to start examining, and I'll give you one way to do that in a little bit. But the invitation is to true nakedness. And he tells this to Achan. They tell this to Achan, this is what you need to do. But they had to force him to do it rather than him receiving the invitation to do it.
No, he didn't come forward right away.
Nope.
He didn't come forward
until he was forced to, right?
Yeah,
and forcing is always going to cause death. Always. And I'll share that in a minute. But give glory means to establish God's honor. Establish the fact that he has the right to decide what will be good for your priesthood and what will not. He has the right to decide what is good and what is evil for you. He alone has that right. Establish that. Then it says, give praise. And give praise is a really interesting word. It actually means to extend the arm, to reconnect in Shazak, to confess. It says, you're right, God. I let you go thinking I have the right to decide what's good for my life and what's bad. I let you go on that because I decided I did. But you're right. I don't. Not only do I not have the right, I'm not very good at it. I don't know what. So I'm going to reconnect. That's the give praise. That's what that word means. So when I talk about giving praise, it doesn't mean saying, oh, God, you're great. It means saying, I've disconnected from you. I took that. That was wrong. I'm going to reconnect. I believe that you do have the right, and you do know what is best for me. You do know what will give me life and make me grow in my priesthood. And then tell. So those two are for God, and then tell is for others. Tell it to others. Bring it to light. Reveal it. The hidden things in your life, you bring to light so that you actually, and then we're going to talk a little bit more about how you identify those, you bring them out, but you do tell others. Because telling others, what does that do? To tell others that you have a tendency to steal time from somebody by speeding. You have a tendency to steal love from somebody by giving them exactly what they give you that hurt you. What does that do when you tell people, I have that tendency?
Then they know.
So number one, it helps them. How does it help you?
It breaks the stronghold. Yeah.
It just,
yeah.
Right.
You feel like this release.
Right. First of all, I'm open. I'm honest. Somebody else knows. And now somebody else gets to be in it with me, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they'll say, hey, your turn. Are you stealing love? They help. Mm-hmm. You're asking them. When I tell someone, you're asking them to be with you in it, mm-hmm. to help you there. I'm going to give you two stories that show exactly how and how bad it gets when we hide those tendencies of stealing from God, of making decisions. So I know two pastors who both had tendencies towards sexual sin. The one pastor chose to tell his wife, and then he chose to tell his congregation. Talk about vulnerability. Now, I will tell you, because I've worked with so many pastors, this it's a really common theme. But it's not really common for to do what this man did. He not only told his wife, that certainly gave him accountability, right? So his wife was, I mean, he knew. So he couldn't hide it. When I hide it, it grows, right? And I can do it more and more and more. I've told my wife now, it's going to be hard to do it. Now I've told my congregation. Risky, right? Because like Kim said, some people are going to go, well, I'm not going to listen to him anymore, which would be really sad, because why don't they want to listen to him anymore?
Because they deem that as bad too, though.
Because now they have to encounter their own, mm-hmm. right?
They're doing the same.
Yeah. So that's one pastor. I'm trying to think if these pastors are almost the same age. I think they are. The other pastor, tendency towards sexual sin, told no one. In fact, he did just the opposite. His whole ministry, from all my experiences, was really geared toward condemning sexual sin. How bad it was, how bad it was. He didn't tell his wife. He didn't tell his congregation. The man is in jail for sexual sin right now. Here we have this other pastor. The church is flourishing. This pastor, not only has he brought death to himself, but whom else? The church. So the church, as soon as it happened, the church right away on their website cut him off. You know, now the church, because the church is afraid, now everyone's going to think that's who we are, which is kind of sad, because actually what the church should have done is said, okay, this is who we all are. How are we going to deal with it? Who else did it hurt? His family. His wife and his many children are left without any support. He was the only one working. He was the breadwinner. They have no support. There's a lot of death that comes along with you hiding the ways you steal. It's not the thing that you steal. It's the fact that you hide it and don't say, I'm a harlot. People come along and help me.
And I have to believe it was such a huge invitation for that first pastor. I can't imagine how many people went up to him and said, oh my gosh,
yes.
Thank you.
Yes, exactly,
you know?
Exactly, yes. So risky and vulnerable, yep. Will you lose? Yep. But as Scripture says, are you willing to lose your life in order to gain it or not? And now this man, now he's dealing with, he was forced to be exposed. And just now, he's beginning to be able to start exposing more. And just now, he and his wife are starting to talk about this. And this has been, I don't know, maybe a year. That happens to all of us, guys. Hiding it never brings us life. It will eventually explode and bring us death, and death to our loved ones as well. Yeah. In reality, it does, doesn't it? Yeah. Because, I mean, think about dealing with that. And this is tough.
And it's so cruel.
Mm-hmm.
It's crueler to live.
Yes, it is. It's really, really hard, isn't it? Because then you're like, you've been ripped open.
Oh my goodness.
And now whatever happens is going to happen is going to be much worse. We'll talk about the family thing in a minute. Yes, we got plenty of time. So God's victory. What's the victory here in Achan? Remember, he said he will never fail us. The word fail meaning he will never leave us unwhole. He will never allow that to continue. And so he looks at Israel as one body, and he says, I am going to excise this. I'm going to cut this out. I'm going to expose it so that it doesn't continue to grow. Hidden ways of stealing, hidden ways of taking life, making self-satisfying ourselves, satisfying, making, meeting our own needs, hidden ways will always grow like a cancer. They will grow and they will continue to spread. And when that happens, when it's not exposed, we begin to support those ways. Well, it's okay because everybody does it. And we begin to support them, and then it becomes a way of life. And God says, I'm not going to leave you that way. That leaves you more and more fragmented, not more and more whole. if I don't deal with it, if I don't excise it, remember again, all of this happened to them physically, but only once, so that it would be a lesson for us to understand what's going on within the real kingdom, within ourselves. Why to you and the loved ones? Why do the loved ones get killed here? Well, let's think through this. They live in a tent where he has dug in the middle of his living room a pile, put stuff there, and a cloak.
They must have known.
Ah.
They knew, and maybe they are corrupted
okay.
by his actions.
Yes. So, and here's why. What happens, and this is the saddest thing about when you hide stuff like that. You force people, the people closest to you, to either take the risk of being a priest and coming to you and saying, hey, this is not the way that you're going to live. This is not whole. But that's risky, right? Because either, if you've hidden something, you're already going to be defensive. So you make your family, your loved ones, the people around you afraid, because certainly you haven't modeled going first, being a priest. So they already know this is going to be scary if I confront. So maybe it's easier just not to say anything. We're just not going to talk about it. And therefore, we support, right? Which in psych terms, what do we call that? Codependency, enablers, right? That's what it is. That's what's happening with Achan's family here. Because we also know God says he will never punish a son for the father's sin. But he will excise what you have done as well. And you have hidden, you have allowed that to be hidden, knowing it's there. Does that make sense? That happens. We all know that happens, right? We all know, you know, sometimes it's just too scary to be a priest and confront and uplift and say, hey, this is who you really are. This is who you guys made you to be. Not someone who's going to take away God's harem. That's scary, right? That's just, they're going to get mad at me. And this is stealing again. They're going to get mad at me. I'm not going to have the love I need. So I'll cover up so that I get the love I need.
Which is, you know, when you do that, it's that loss thing. Because the first thing they do is go, but you're not doing so great at it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yeah. So it's this battle. But it's this, what do I want most? I want love. If they're going to get mad at me, I feel like that's cutting off love. So I don't want to unveil that so I can get love. I mean, talk about schizophrenic. That's what that is, right? But we all do that. We all do that.
They probably rationalize it.
Of course.
It's not that big a deal.
Right.
Just a little bit of
right. Oh, I'll bet Joe next door took another mantle.
But
I'll bet they did.
They don't realize that, 36 people died.
Right. Exactly. So 36 people died. People on the outside died because there's a disconnection. Because all disconnection in the body will affect everybody.
Remember that what God is doing us is showing us the reality.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, when all these people die, you know, you have like 12,000 dying here, you have that stuff. Like, you're like, oh, like, all these people are being put to death. It's so hard.
I know.
And then you're like, okay, like, he didn't put anything to death that wasn't already dead.
Right.
And he
right.
Show us what
right.
Like
exactly.
Even recognize
yes. Exactly.
But it's still so.
It's still
so
hard.
Because we've
it's
gotten
hard.
Used to, especially without sacrifices.
Yep.
Thinking that there isn't blood in our hands.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Well, and how many people? I mean, we go to the store and we buy packages of meat, and you know, that's how it is. That's how it comes, right? That's how God gives it to us. You know, packaged and ground, and that's how it comes. We're not used to death, but death is reality. Death is definitely reality. So we do see that.
Can you imagine if it wasn't so bluntly given to us this way,
uh-huh.
how easy it would be to overlook it, though, too?
Right.
You need to look at the dirty
right.
truth, which
right.
is these, you know, he brought this upon his family with
mm-hmm.
his choices.
Mm-hmm.
He disobeyed God's word and will willingly.
Yep.
Like, we need
yep.
to see that. Otherwise, it's easier
right.
for us to rationalize.
That's
you almost
right.
have to read... I was the same way. I was like, oh gosh,
like why so? Yeah,
not a happy little picture here,
mm-hmm.
but we need
mm-hmm.
that.
But
Because we're sometimes is, like, you know, I think of a family as mom, dad, and four kids or whatever. And I think they're not talking about just the four kids who witness it.
It's his tribe.
It's the brothers,
yeah,
the sisters, the cousins. They're all these are adults living, and they witnessed it, and they hit it.
Yep.
So, granted, there's kids involved.
Yep.
And I kind of sometimes lump that to more innocence.
Right, right,
but
right.
But these are adults that chose
yep.
to hide also.
Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Think about that movie, Kingdom something, where it's in the Middle East and the army, and it's just that continuum of, you know, you can kill the big chief, but yet the kids have seen it.
Right, so exactly.
They've already got that.
Exactly. And that's exactly what it is. Exactly what it is. And so God says, we need to start excising those out of your life. Those are the things in your life. So take it from that big picture to the small picture of you, the small picture of us as community. There are things in our lives that we're hiding, that we're stealing from God, that we're self-satisfying ourselves. And so these are our piles here. So we had the independent walls come down, and now the hidden spoil here. And he says, you know, there are things you're hiding because you're trying to steal them from God as if they're there, if they're your right to take. And then we go into AI, the self-satisfying, the actual little things that we actually self-satisfy with, how we satisfy ourselves to get what we think we need to make us our feel better. So what's the most common thing for each of you that you go to self-satisify yourself?
Shopping.
Okay, shopping is like one of number
food.
One. Food is number two, right? Those two things. Sleep.
TV.
Right, TV, yep, those would be good. So those are definitely the things that we self-satisfy with. And we're really saying, well, I'm not getting life here, so I'm going to go and get life for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go make sure I buy something. I'm going to make sure. And, you know, here is the raw truth of it. I've been really good with not eating, and I do eat out of feeling like I'm not getting life. I have been really good. Last night, in the middle of the night, midnight, I woke up, I was a little mad, and I thought, I have Kit Kats in there. I have Kit Kats. Jill, don't eat Kit Kats. Those are a gift from God. Take them as a gift. Okay, fine. Well, then I had those plantain chips. Okay, I sat down on the couch and I ate plantain chips in the middle of the night. Had a little iced tea with it. Well, that was a good idea. And then, because I took that as if it was my right, I finally said, well, I should have at least one Kit Kat. And of course, I took a Kit Kat. Here I am in the middle of the night taking because I felt like I wasn't getting full life. I wasn't getting everything I wanted, what I thought I needed. And I wasn't quite sure God was going to give it to me in my time. We do that all the time, right? We self-satisfy. So God is going to give us ways in which to battle those. Of course, when he does this with Achan and he exposes it, he restores Israel. And now Israel gets a second chance to go back into Ai this time. They get to reconnect with God because that part of hiddenness is gone. That exposure has been out there. You know, Achan, it didn't have to go that way for Achan. Understand that, and we'll see that kind of in the end. He could have given glory and given praise and told before he was forced to. And then there would have been different consequences. And we know that because there's altars. And the altars are always the way to be able to come back. So the last thing is washing up with fire. So we know a priest gets chosen to come and be God's again, not his own. He gets exposed. He gets undressed. But then he gets washed. And so what we have with them going into Ai and setting up the ambush is the washing with fire. Remember, fire in the Bible is almost always a tool of God to use to purify. So we saw that in Deuteronomy over and over again, that the fire was his loving way to purify. It's how we talk about silver becoming pure fire to get rid of the dross. That's what he's doing here, is he washing them with fire.
Are these things named after the fact? You know what I mean? Like, if Ai means heap of ruin.
Yes.
Okay. Like, is it really that name before? Or was it given another name?
Correct. Almost always it's given after the fact. So that's true. But remember, the reason these stories are told is to teach us. Therefore, God puts those and says, let's name it this because I want to teach them. So AI is taking that rubble, that heap, and by the way, it says it's next to Beth Avon, which means city of vanity. Mm-hmm. So the heap, the heap of flesh that we've left with our independence, they're kind of picking that up for vanity, for pride. So it's really the fleshly tendencies, the specifics of how I'm independent and hiding spoil. Self-satisfaction, the very specifics of how I do that. God's prescription is to wash out those. First, set an ambush. In other words, lie in wait. Be alert to places in your life that need to get out of there, that need to not be a part of you any longer. Like the Eskimos, that you've sewn onto yourself as if they're a piece of you, the ways you self-satisfy, be aware of those places. Be just completely, oh, I self-satisfy here. Oh, this is how I self-satisfy. This is my theft tendencies here. This is where I tend to think I have the right to decide what's good and bad for me here. I have the right to go and get it rather than wait for God to give it.
But I find if I get rid of it in one place, then I transfer it to another place.
Ah, yes.
Like, so maybe it was self-satisfying, but now I'm like, doing something else,
right? And
so
of course,
I'm just replacing it.
And that's why the ambush isn't just that they come out and they kill them, right? What do? They go back to the city and they set it on fire, right? So they draw the ambush, they draw them out from the city. In other words, they rip off that clothes that have been sewn and they rip it off and take it away. They say, this is not who you are. This is not a part of you. This is your covering. So when I look at the ways I self-satisfy, when I look at the fact that I'm eating a Kit Kat at midnight, I look at that and God says, that's your covering. You're covering up the fact that you're trying to get life for yourself through this. That's your covering. I'm just ripping your covering off. I'm not trying to rip off gifts that I'm giving you. In fact, I gave you that Kit Kat as a gift, but you took it in a time and a place that I didn't give it to you. You took it. So draw it from the city. It's not a part of you. It's just your covering. And then make no room for return. And this is where you're talking about, Kim. They were told to set the city on fire, completely get rid of it so that they couldn't come back and live in it again, right? Achan held on to the power by looking and being near it. In other words, you find out, you think to yourself, well, shopping is one way I self-satisfy myself. And God says, keep yourself, tend the garden well, don't go near, don't look at the harem, don't look at the harem. So if shopping is your tendency towards self-satisfaction, then how are you going to keep yourself from it? How are you going to tend your garden well? I'm not going to start thinking, you know, if I go to the loft and just look and see what's on sale. Or, well, they wanted to go to the loft, so maybe I should go with them. You know, maybe I should just walk downtown Naperville. I should just walk downtown Naperville.
No,
just
window shop. If I buy a fair trade dress.
Yeah.
It's not. Yeah.
Right, exactly. Because then I'm helping. Then I'm being a priest, right? So I can, again, there's my saintlyhood bringing it up, right? So I begin thinking about ways to manipulate it. So that I can actually be close to it. But I'm not going to do it. I'm just going to go window shopping, right? Or, well, with the Kit Kats, why do I even have them in my house? Well, I'm just going to have them so that God can give me a gift. I mean, it's ridiculous, the things that
when
we
I
do.
When I want it.
Yeah, right, when I want it, yeah.
You know what this reminds me of is Asherah poles.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, so yeah, the main altar is dedicated to God, but you have all these other little places where there's still other little things going on. Mm-hmm. And I find it interesting that they put the king on a pole. It's kind of like those areas that are still left out after.
Yeah, exactly. Remember, and we've talked about this before, so when a thought comes into your mind, fine, you didn't bring the thought into your mind most of the time, or an emotion. Oh, I would feel so good if I had a Kit Kat bar. That emotion, Carmel, do you remember this?
90 seconds.
Thank you. It only resides in your brain 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. After 90 seconds, and this is physiological, what happens in your brain, after 90 seconds, you choose to store it on the other side of your brain. You choose. Unless you choose, it doesn't remain in your brain. So that choosing, an emotion in your brain lasts only 90 seconds. After 90 seconds, you either choose to keep it in your brain or let it go. When you choose to keep it in your brain, then you put it on the other side of the brain. So now it's solid. You've established it. And now once it's established, what do you usually do with a thought like that?
You start looping it.
Yeah. You marinate it, right?
And then you start thinking the scenarios.
And you start thinking through, well, this is what happened, so I'm going to do this.
You create a pathway in your brain.
Physiologically, you create. You create pathways in your brain so that it becomes in your brain reality.
It does.
That's what Aiken did. Mm-hmm. It's reality that it's mine. It's there for the taking. Mm-hmm. I deserve it. Yeah. And you start... I deserve that kick. I've been really good, so and this is what you say. I've been really good, so I deserve it. My efforts equal I get something. It's a gift.
And what we teach is that when you stop covering it with shopping, with eating, with sex, with drinking, with whatever, when you stop doing that, you open yourself up. So what we do is we become vulnerable.
Exactly.
So how do you out it? How do you burn it? You become vulnerable.
Yep, exactly.
So whatever it is that is creating that urge for cover.
Yep.
And that's how you change your...
Your brain pattern.
That's also how you change your
right.
your behavior. So if you just do, when you look at it, just realize that...
Like when I text you that I'm playing Candy Crush Saga.
Yes, exactly. And that, and here it is.
That I spent $20 trying to clear a board. Yes.
So when you share that, when we share that with one another, which is what community is about, which is what the priesthood is about, the other one should be acting as your priest.
Yes.
Yep.
It's not going to give you life. That's death. That's death. I mean,
that's all.
And that was my first thought when somebody texted me, this is what I'm doing. I'm doing this, this, and I said, sounds like death to me. Yeah, it is. That's death. That's a priesthood, right? That's lifting you up because I want life for you. So this is why we open up. This is why we're vulnerable. This is why we share. So that the pastor who stands in front of his congregation and says, look, my tendencies are toward a sexual sin. I'm telling you right now this. So that you will be priest to me. I'm asking you to be a priest to me. That is the opening up. That is the making room for no return. God's victory then is symbolized in Joshua outstretching his javelin, which should have brought you back to Moses stretching out his thing, which should have brought you back to God's outstretched arm is the one that saved them. It's got all along in all of these, it can't be just you. It has to be God in your presence. And of course, then we have the king of Ai being put up on a tree. And remember, since we're always going back and forward, what does that remind you of? Right, Jesus on a tree, right? Because Jesus' body there on the tree reminds us of the fleshly ways we self-satisfy, of the ways we choose to get life for ourselves and be independent, and that's what he hangs on the tree, is that body. The interesting thing is the spoils from the treasure here in Ai, now they're God says, okay, and now you get plunder. Now you get spoils. Now you get to take this. He says, my intention has never been to keep it from you. My intention is let me sift it through my hands because I know what kind of spoils are going to be good for you. And now I'm going to give you immense plunder, immense spoils, all sorts of things. If Ai had only waited for God to give rather than take, he and his family would be living and getting the inheritance, getting all that. God is always, he says he's always giving you abundantly, more than you can ever imagine, right? He wants to give it to you, and he knows when the best time to give it to you is, and he knows what it's going to look like to give it to you. He knows the kind of spoils you need to become more and more a priest. Then the whole thing kind of turns. We have these battles, and we understand we're the battle of our independent walls and the battle of hidden spoil and the battle of self-satisfaction. And then all of a sudden, they're like, I don't know, 120 miles north in Israel. Like all of a sudden, they're at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal. Okay, so for those of you who did Deuteronomy, what are those two mountains?
The blessing and the curse.
The blessing and the curse. In Deuteronomy, God told Moses and Joshua both, when you go into the land, I want you to go into this place. This is in the middle of the nation Israel, eventually the nation Israel. This is in the very middle. So in the north, it's weird. It's almost like the author like forgot what he was talking about, and now he's talking about this. How in the world does that work here? What's going on that now they're all of a sudden there in this place of what he has them do there? In Deuteronomy, it tells them, when you go there, you're going to do some things in order to celebrate. This is going to be a place of celebration where you're going to eat a meal in my presence and have joy. This is what we're going to do here. So the first thing he says is Joshua is to build an altar there. Joshua is going to build an altar on which mountain? Mount Ebal. Which one is that? It's the mountain of curses, which should start going, well, that's weird. Wouldn't you build it on Mount Gerizim? Of uncut stones. And anytime you see them build an altar of uncut stones, there is this hint of, this isn't about what man does. This is something about God. And so, of course, as you've seen over and over again, all these stones in Joshua, if you just continue to read throughout in all the stones in the New Testament, who is the uncut stone? Jesus, the cornerstone, right? The uncut, the stone that not made. In Daniel, we have the same thing of the uncut stone that crushes. We have these stones over and over again. So we have the altar, Joshua building the altar, a place that they're going to give burnt and peace offering, which is always an asking for forgiveness and a desire to reconcile again. So that's, we have that and the law written on it. God's victory here. So his prescription is to build an altar on Mount Ebal. God's victory here is that the tribes are surrounding the ark in the space in between. So the space between. Here's something that you probably don't know. That space there is actually the city of Shechem. That's what sits between Ebal and Gerizim. Anybody know what's happened in Shechem before? Yeah, that's true. That happened there, which was all about getting them to be circumcised and be in covenant.
Right.
But then they destroyed it.
Right.
What else happened in Shechem? Anybody else know? The very first thing that happened in Shechem, it's the very first city that Abraham came to when he was called out of Ur. And it's where God said, Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. This is the land I'm giving you. And it is the first altar that was built toward God. Abraham builds an altar in Shechem. Right there where they're standing, this is where God has promised the land. It's where Abraham says, I'm connected to you. Remember, he came out of a people who wasn't connected, and he's connected to them in Shechem. It's also the very first piece of land that Jacob bought for 100 shekels. Remember, Jacob actually buys a piece of the land before mm-hmm. they all go out of the land. It's the very first time that there is actual possession of this land. Way before this happens, Jacob has bought Shechem. One other thing happens in Shechem way after this. And it's actually with somebody meeting a woman at a well. The well, by the way, is Jacob's because he bought that piece of property. Anybody know what happens there?
The woman at the well with Jesus.
Same place. And he comes to her and he says, I have living water to give you. And there will come a time, and she says, my ancestors say we worship in this mountain. And what she's pointing to is Gerizim, the mountain of blessings. Because if you came as a Samaritan, which is a half Jew and a half pagan, you come and you want to worship God. They wanted to worship God. And they looked at these two mountains, one of the mountains of blessing, one's the cursing. Well, I don't want to be a sinner, I want to be a saint. I want to be the one that follows the law well and gets blessings. So they worship on Gerizim. And Jesus says, there's going to come a time when you won't worship on Mount Gerizim. You won't worship on trying to do the law so you get blessings. And you also won't worship in Jerusalem, where we've basically done the same thing. You will worship in spirit. because it is in spirit where you are actually connected. Remember, it's the three, us. It's not me by myself trying to do that. So we have that. That's where they are. That's in Shechem, between Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim. So they're not standing on either. They're actually standing in between. Here's the ark. Here are all the priests and all the people surrounding them. And he reads the law, the blessings, and the curses. And what we have is this mysterious picture of somehow, God is here. We have him in the ark. We have his word being read. We have the word. But then we have this altar on the mountain of Ebal, on the mountain of curses. Somehow it's not going to be about me. I want to be a priest. Is it going to be about my efforts? Am I going to be able to live on Mount Gerizim and have all the blessings? That's what I want, right? God says, you're not going to be able to do it. You are going to fail. You are going to be on Mount Ebal. So what do I have to put on Mount Ebal? But a place where I will be the sacrifice, so that you can have both. Mysteriously, God stays in the tension of trying, of that desire to be the place of blessing, but also knowing I'm a place of curses, that I am both priest and harlot, and he stands in the middle, and it's his presence that makes it possible to call us back to fullness in the spirit, which Jesus kind of fulfills toward the end. Here's an easy way, and this is what I think I'd like us to do. There's a lot here, right? How am I going to go home and think about all this? We're going to go back to the fact that he's calling us to show up. He's calling us to be vulnerable. He's calling us to show up in who we are, both priest and harlot. And so for us to say, I'm going to take one of these rocks, and I'm going to say, I do self-satisfy. I do try to be independent. I do try to hide. I am a harlot. Because you already have a priest rock at home. I want you to take a rock of this and say, this is who I am also. And so I'm going to come every day and say, like Samuel and like Moses, when God called them to connect with him, Moses, Moses, he says, Samuel, Samuel. And what do they respond? Here I am. Here I am. In all that I am, right now, right here, here I am. Here I am. My harlotry and my priesthood. Here I am. I'm going to meet the fact that you've connected your existence with me. So here I am. I'm showing up. Knowing here you are as well. Here you are, God, in all your mystery, in this mystery of this end where he clothes us in his presence, but I don't quite get it because there's more in this. But man, it's just, it's shadowy and I'm not sure. I don't fully know God, but he fully knows me. And all there's an invitation. Show up. Come out. Be exposed. Say, I'm here, God. Here I am in all my harlotry and in all my priesthood. This is who I am. And here you are with me. We're here together. Wow, that begins to make a life where I can actually do this. A life where I actually going to have grace. The celebration here is not that they are becoming great priests. The celebration here is there will always be his presence to give the grace to continue to make us into who we're meant to be. So what I'd like us to do is I'd like you to take a rock from any of the piles. It doesn't matter because we have all three of these piles. I want you to put on it. I want you to write on it with your pen, or if I can go get some markers I forgot to get. Here I am.
I need a big one.
And then on the other side of the rock, here you are. And I want you to carry that around with you all week. To center yourself, to bring yourself to, look, here I am in all my harlotry and all my priesthood. Here you are with me. You've connected your existence with me. And me being brought out into the open helps me to connect with you. When I'm hiding, I'm disconnecting. And I just want to see if it gives you any more of a deeper understanding of letting yourself be revealed, letting yourself be exposed in the places that we don't want to be, whether it's our sainthood or our harlotry, realizing that the grace is the fact that he continues to connect himself with you. When I show up, when I don't show up, I'm putting that wall there, and I can't see that he's there, and I can't see that he's there with me. So on one side, here I am. And the other side, here you are. It's the two sides of life, and it is the truth and the reality of what it is.
Jill, this totally reminds me of an NPR interview I was listening to yesterday. And it was Michael Pollan talking about his new book called Cook. And he was talking about, and essentially that image of cooked is how we've taken food and kind of made it into this process that brings us more depth than it does life.
Mm-hmm.
And how to get back to the place with food that brings us life again, you know? Which, I mean, of course, it's fill in the blank.
Right.
To be food. And so the guy was interviewing him was like, okay, but how do we do this? Like, really, give us a path of, like, how do we go from, like, the way we've done food to the way it brings the most life? And he said, well, I've learned this when my travels in the Middle East, and he said, and I heard this great culinary man speak this to me, and it almost sounded like a path for spirituality more than cooking. He's like, but good cooks know that's both. And he said it's patience, it's practice, and it's presence.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was like Joshua.
That's Joshua. Yep, exactly.
I mean, like
yep.
Patience.
Yep.
Of walking around the wall.
Right.
Seven times.
Right.
Letting the emotion of 90 seconds pass, of all these things, and the practice of that. Making new neural pathways,
right.
And then the presence of being present with the the lamb, essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
So it just reminded me of this whole thing.
That's it. And that I hope not everything that we do in class will spark your intimacy with God, but hopefully one of these will. That's why I try to do something every week with take something home. This may spark you to pull back in. Look, God is existing with me, with who I am. He doesn't exist when I'm just a priest. He exists with me. He chose Rahab when she was a harlot. He chose to say, I want to connect with you. He chooses all of us in those places. If I don't think that, I will not connect with him until I think I'm good enough, and then my connection will be because I deserved it. Does that make sense? So here I am in all my fullness. If I can show up every single day, sometimes, and lately this week I've been doing this, like every 10 minutes sometimes I need to say, okay, God, here I am. I'm showing up. This is who I am. I am being a harlot here. I'm being a harlot here, trying to be a priest here, but this is who I am. And here you are. What grace that is to know that it's existent, connected with mine, exactly who I am. And then it gives me much more of a firm foundation to be able to receive the gifts that he's giving me and not take. To be able to be a priest and allow my harlotry to actually be open there. Because I am not a priest because I deserve it. It is a gift. It is all still. And it's always going to go back to, I am a receiver. I am not a taker. I am not a worker. I am a receiver, and God is the giver. Father, thank you that you alone are the giver of life. Thank you that you remind us daily that we cannot create life, that we create walls that suffocate us, that suffocate others, that bring death. Father, I pray that this week that we would remember that you call us to be out in the open. Here we are. In all our harlotry, in all our priesthood. And yet here you are with us, connecting your existence with us, that we might receive the grace of being connected with you in us. Lord, might this week we walk as one who is willing to receive and not be takers, not be thieves, not steal what is your right to divide, and that we might receive everything you give us in this day, and in this week, as a gift to build up our priesthood, to recognize our independence, to allow you to take it down brick by brick. You, God, are such a good giver. In Jesus' name, amen.